I think this is the first chapter where we're getting to material of sort of obvious relevance to the job of a lawyer in the chapter on contracts. And most of it, although it isn't quite put that way, is really an economist's view of contracts, which isn't really the same as a lawyer's view of contracts, but nonetheless I think is quite useful since it helps explain not what rules can or cannot be legally enforced, or what will happen, what the courts will do, but rather, what are you trying to do in designing a contract? How would you figure out whether you had your contract right, and so forth? And that. All righty. Thanks that I have this on here. Let's just quit this for a moment and bring it up again. Hopefully is useful, and in a sense it's really making a few very simple points and then just working them through in a great deal of detail. And the basic points are first, the idea that what you really want to do is to maximize the size of the pie, which isn't a full story. Obviously you also want to maximize your share of it, but economics doesn't have a whole lot to say about how you win bilateral monopoly bargaining games. It has a good deal to say about how you maximize the size of the pie, so that's what the chapter is really dealing with, and then making a point about incentives as important in how you maximize the size of the pie. Let me start, as usual, by reviewing what we did. What we were covering at the end of the last week was insurance. We looked at the idea of risk aversion, which I claim is a misleading term for declining marginal utility of income, but which means that you would rather have a certain income of $100,000 than a 50-50 chance of 50 or 150, basically. We then looked at moral hazard as it's usually seen in the insurance literature, where it's a bug, where it's a problem, where the basic moral hazard problem is that the person who would normally bear the loss, such as the owner of a house or a factory, is also the person in the best position to prevent the loss. The more of the loss is covered by insurance, the weaker his incentive is to prevent it. And of course, what we want is not an infinite incentive. There are precautions you shouldn't take because they cost more than they're worth. We want the right incentive, which means that we want the benefit to me for taking a precaution to be equal to the amount on average saved by the precaution, which will happen if I bear the full loss, but not if I only bear half or a tenth of the loss because of insurance. So that's essentially the standard problem of moral hazard. One way of controlling it is to try to have the insurance company require a sprinkler system in other ways to make the choice. Another way of partly controlling it is by coinsurance, by insuring for a good deal less than the full value of the property. And the one non-obvious point, which I don't think they made in it, but which I think is worth making, is that having me bear half the cost results typically in less than half the problems of having me bear none of the cost. That is to say, when I go from 100% insurance to 50% insurance, I improve things a good deal more than I would in going 50% to zero. And the reason is that when I'm bearing half the cost, the precautions I'm not taking are the precautions that are only moderately profitable, the ones that pay less than 2 for 1. Whereas if I bear none of the costs, then I don't take precautions even if they pay 100 to 1. Now, is that point clear or not clear? If you think about what's the problem, the problem is my failing to take precautions that are worth more than they cost. If I fail to take a precaution that's worth a little bit more than it costs, that's not a very big problem. So I've thrown away $100. If I fail to take a precaution that is worth enormously more than it costs, I've thrown away $10,000. But insurance, if I bear half the cost, 50% coinsurance, that means that any precaution worth at least twice what it costs, it'll pay me to take. So therefore, as we get closer and closer to my bearing the full cost, the inefficiencies we eliminate by my bearing more of the cost become smaller and smaller inefficiencies. And if you intuit that point, it turns out to be useful for quite a lot of economic issues that have nothing to do with insurance. For example, the same argument, and I'll leave this as an exercise for any of you who've got a background in economics, is the reason why the deadweight cost of getting all your tax revenue from taxing one thing is generally much larger than the deadweight cost of getting your tax revenue from small taxes on many different things. But I'll let you think about that. But it's the same basic argument. All right. I then went on to the point which often doesn't get made with moral hazard, and that is that sometimes it's a feature rather than a bug, because sometimes the owner of the property is not the one in the best position to control the loss. And in that case, transferring the loss to someone else who is in a better position to control it is actually a win, a gain. And one example I mentioned is that people often buy service contracts even for not very expensive appliances. That seems to make no sense from a risk aversion standpoint, since the loss is small compared to your total wealth. But it makes sense if you think that Sears, who you've bought the service contract from, is actually better able to make sure that your washing machine gets repaired well at a reasonable cost than you are, and you therefore want to transfer the responsibility to them. We then spoke a little bit about adverse selection, often known as the market for lemons because of a classic article by Akerlof which had that title. And it deals with asymmetrical information, with situations where one party knows something that the other party doesn't. For example, the seller of a used car knows it's a lemon and the buyer doesn't. And the problem with asymmetric information is that it can result in goods failing to sell even though they're worth more to the buyer than to the seller. Because if it's a high-quality good, the buyer knows that and therefore will only accept fairly high price offers. The buyer doesn't know it's a high-quality good and therefore won't make those high price offers, and therefore the good doesn't sell. And because buyers are aware of this phenomenon, they realize that if their offer to buy the car is accepted, that's a signal that it's probably a lemon, and they adjust their offers accordingly down to take account of that. And that's the problem of adverse selection. And you can think of quite a lot of other contexts where the same problem arises. And it comes not from ignorance, but from asymmetric information. That if neither party knows whether the car is a lemon, there's no problem. If both parties know whether the car is a lemon, there's no problem. If one party knows whether the car is a lemon but can prove it to the other, there's no problem. The problem is when I know whether it's a lemon, but I have no convincing way of showing you that it's not a lemon. And that's a problem that shows up in quite a lot of contexts and is one you want to think about if you're setting up legal arrangements. Any questions on this stuff? This is all review. Let's apply it to a case which I think I have as the reading, but which is actually quite an interesting real-world issue, and that's genetic testing. That we now know that many of the things that kill people are in large part genetic. That whether I die of a heart attack, if I'm really lucky in my ancestors, I can eat lots of high-fat diet and smoke and do all sorts of other stupid things and still be unlikely to die of a heart attack. Whereas if I have really bad luck in my parents in that respect, then I can live a pretty abstemious life and still drop dead at 55 when my heart starts beating. And that's true of a bunch of other things. There are some purely genetic diseases that we know about, Tay-Sachs, sickle cell anemia and such, and there are lots of others with this genetic component. We are very rapidly learning much more about this subject because we now, just over the last few years, have the tools to very inexpensively determine what genes somebody has, to genotype a living organism, including us. And that may mean in the not very distant future, to some extent even at present, a situation where a genetic test can give you quite a lot of information about your future health risks. Not certainty, of course, but you might easily imagine that after the test, your chance of dying at 50 is either doubled or cut in half, say, with that information. And that then raises issues with regard to insurance. That the basic that we have in a sense two different problems. One of them is that you can't insure against a risk if the result is already known. All right, if you imagine saying, all right, my house just burned down, now I'd like to buy fire insurance to compensate myself, you will find that the sellers are not willing to sell you fire insurance once they know your house is burned down. we would like to be able to insure against health risks. But if the health risk has already happened, because it happened when we were born, in our genes, and that information is available, it becomes uninsurable. That's one half of it. And the other half, as you'll see, is the problems of adverse selection if the information exists but is asymmetrical. So think about the alternatives. Start out in the situation of 10 years ago. There are no relevant tests for good or bad genes, that at least that are relevant to most people's situation. Second possibility, imagine what some people recommend. Somebody recommending this started me thinking about this question. Tests exist. Individuals can get tested, but it's illegal for the insurance company to say to the customer, we will only insure you if you get tested and turn over the results of the test to us. All right. And the third alternative is there is a test, people can get tested, but insurance companies can make the insurance conditional on tests and on their getting the information. So the question then is, in each of those cases, what's going to happen? Before I go on, do you have thoughts on that? Are we better off or worse off when we discover how to do this testing?
Depends on how good your genes are.
Well, maybe. That might be one thing it depends on. It's a little unclear. You could argue that the testing is particularly valuable to people with bad genes because they now know what precautions to take. But, yeah?
Well, it seems like if communicable diseases are less important, right, and genetic diseases start becoming the main thing we suffer from, heart disease and other things like
right.
that, cancer, insurance companies are going to start losing money as a result. Because people who get, let's say if everybody gets tested, everybody knows, right? It's like people who already have great outlook, they say, well, I'm going to get insurance for only a few things that are not genetic diseases, and we'll say...
This is in a world where the insurance company doesn't have the results of the test.
Well, or even if they do, because then they'll give
them... Let's pick one of them first.
Let's say they don't know the results of the test.
The insurance company is not allowed to ask the results of the test.
But they will know the results of the test because people, by people's actions, they can...
But they don't know the results of the test, so they know whether people bought insurance.
Yeah.
Now, what happens if you got a really good test result? If your results tell you, I'm very unlikely to drop dead.
Then I'm not going to get insured for... heart disease or cancer, whatever
right.
stuff that I'm not...
And the insurance company knows this.
Yeah, they're going to know this now.
So how is this going to affect the insurance company's policies?
Well, they're going to want to insure the likelihood of me...
They don't know that you got a good test result.
Yeah.
This is the world where they don't know the results, but you do.
Yeah.
They know that if you got a good test result, you're not going to buy insurance.
Yeah.
What if you got a bad test result? How will the insurance company modify its behavior as a result of this knowledge? Yep.
They'll
charge higher premiums because they know that the risk pool of people who buy insurance is on average bad risks. The good risks aren't buying, the bad risks are. The insurance company therefore essentially says, all right, we thought this was a gamble where we had one chance in 20 of paying off. It now turns out to be a gamble of one chance in 10, so we're going to charge twice as much to insure you. What is the consequence for you, the moderately good risk, of their raising their rates?
You're going to get the high rates.
What?
You're going to get the high rates.
Are you? Are you going to choose to get insurance if you know you're a pretty good risk and the rates are based on bad risks?
Well, you're going to be indistinguishable from somebody who has a high risk, right, according to the insurance.
That's right, but they're going to charge both of you the same rate, and it's going to be a high rate.
Yeah, exactly.
And
so
now
you'll become either uninsured or you'll...
So you're less likely to be insured.
Yeah.
That fact means that the average of the people who are getting insured is even worse than it would otherwise have been, which again results in a higher... So you're going to end up in an equilibrium where the good risks tend not to be insured, even if they're risk averse, even if they would be like to be insured at a price representing them as good risks. And the very bad risks are essentially all insured, and somewhere in the middle people stop getting insurance. You don't know exactly where. All right? At high rates. How does this compare to the world where the insurance company is allowed to require tests? What happens in that world?
Well, they require tests and then they'll get information.
That's right. So now what happens? You're a good risk. What happens?
They're going to insure you at a good price.
They're going to insure you at a good price. He's a bad risk. They insure him at a bad price. So the result is you can... At that point, what can and what can't you insure against? Putting it differently, what's the respect in which people on average are now worse off than they were in the initial situation where we had no tests?
I still don't understand your answer. Sorry.
In this situation, the person who is a good risk is better off than he would have been with no tests because he's getting the insurance at a cheaper price. The person who's a bad risk is worse off. Is there an interesting sense in which, on average, we're now worse off than we were in the original situation when we didn't have the tests?
Well, yeah, because insurance companies are going to feed off the risk.
But what?
Insurance company feeds off the uncertainty. It seems like something like if you knew that your house was going to burn down exactly at a certain time, right, and the insurance company knew that, then no one's going to do anything about it.
So what you're saying...
They're going to say, well, this is going to happen, the insurance company doesn't...
So what we're saying now is that there are two different risks you would like to insure against. One of them is the risk of having bad genes. The other is, given the genes you have, the risk of dying young.
Yeah, the risk of dying, accident.
The second one is still insurable, but the first is no longer insurable in this world. Because you can't gamble on the coin after you flipped it and read it. Right. So, there are two interesting points here, but one of the interesting points is that it is at least possible that this improvement in knowledge makes us worse off. On average. It makes some people better off, clearly.
Yeah.
But it's possible that it makes us worse off on average because it means that there is an important risk we can no longer insure against, the risk of having bad genes.
So then insurance companies could start asking to isolate two different types of health insurance. So you'd say communicable disease or accident health insurance, and then you'd say, well, genetic disease insurance. And then you have...
But they can't insure for the genetic disease if you can test your genes. Yes?
Yeah, I was going to say that. If it's 100% certain that you're going to get this type of genetic disease, then the insurance company isn't going to insure you because it's going to cost them $100,000 for them to treat your cancer, but you can't possibly pay that $100,000.
Yep. Let's go back a step. Suppose we observe this situation. We observe that we're in a world where genetic risks are uninsurable. And we say, is there any possible way, and whether it's possible is going to depend on technical facts, in which we could... for people who wanted to get back to our initial situation. Could you imagine any ways of, given that the technology exists, how could you imagine still insuring against genetic risks?
Do you have precise information that you don't get tested?
One of them would be if there was some way of not only not getting tested, which is easy, but proving to the insurance company you hadn't been tested. Right? If you can't prove it, then they'll just believe you're lying, that you've got a test and it showed you were a bad risk. But imagine that the testing is difficult enough so it's only done in a few places, and those places are required to keep records of who's been tested. And you can go to the insurance company and say, I will give you permission to ask all of the providers of tests whether I've been tested. They will tell you I have not been tested. Now I want insurance at the old rates, basically. So that would be one way, if the technology made it possible. There's another way, although it's somewhat limited, and that is for you to get the insurance before you're born. You could imagine your parents going to the insurance company and saying, look, we're planning to have a kid. He hasn't been conceived yet, so there's no possible way we can know his genes. We know our genes, but there's still a random draw among our genes as to which ones he gets. So you could imagine, in principle, getting the insurance company to sell insurance on unconceived or not yet conceived children and thus insuring against genetic risks. So those, at least, are the alternatives that I can see. There may be.
But then they can still use data from the parents to adjust.
It yeah,
more very
that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
You aren't insuring against all the genetic risk. You're only insuring against the genetic risk given the parents of the uncertainty.
And then even then, it would have to be quite the insurance company that lasts that long and holds it that time.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's an easy solution. But the interesting point is only that there are possible ways around this, although sort of limited ways around it. Notice that the rule saying you can know when the insurance company can't, which appeals to a lot of people as somehow seeming fair if they can't discriminate, has the consequence, on the one hand, of benefiting the really bad risks, because they're getting charged not the rate for them, but the rate for the average person who is bad enough to buy insurance. But it has a net cost which goes to nobody. In effect, the very bad risks are being benefited at the expense of the moderately bad risks. Because if you imagine somehow that, imagine that you can think of your risks as just to make life simple, I'm going to assume there are only three levels of risk. This, this, and this. This is high risk, medium, and low. And let's suppose the insurance rates end up such that the high and the medium risks end up getting insured at a price that represents an average of theirs and theirs. And the low risks don't get insured. What's now happening is the high-risk people are benefiting at the cost of the medium-risk people. The medium-risk people are getting insured at a price that represents a higher risk than they really are, the high risk, the lower. Nobody is benefiting at the expense of the low-risk people, but the low-risk people are now out of the insurance market, which is a net loss from their standpoint, because they can't get insured. All right. So in that sense, the rule prohibiting genetic discrimination, as it were, does create a certain amount of equality. It does benefit, in this case, the high risk at the expense of the medium risk, but at the expense of the undesirable outcome of driving some people entirely out of the market who it would be profitable to insure if only they could prove that they were good risks. In that sense, it's undesirable. All right. Yes?
This is also assuming that the testing isn't that much, because right now it's extremely expensive to get any type of genetic testing.
Yes.
And so anyone that would get that type of testing would have so much disposable income that they're going to buy insurance regardless.
Well, not necessarily. They might have so much income they didn't think they needed the insurance that they could pay for the. But as best I can tell, genetic testing is getting cheap very rapidly. So I think the current estimates are that in a few years you'll be able to do a full genotype for $1,000 or so, and it could become much cheaper if you go, 10 or 15 years out. So yes. And in addition, my impression is that genetic testing of a much more limited sort, not the whole genotype, but testing for a particular thing, is, I think, fairly inexpensive already. Incidentally, a couple of other points which are really not about insurance, but just relevant because this whole genetic testing is an interesting issue. One of them, of course, is that quite aside from insurance, the genetic testing provides something that's probably a benefit, namely additional information. I say probably because you can imagine the person who doesn't want to know that he's going to die young, who says, I might as well enjoy it. But for a lot of people, knowing that you're probably going to only make it to 70 will let you adjust your life plans in ways that fit that, rather than planning on all the things you're going to do at 80 and 90, which you never get to. The other interesting point, of course, is that genetic testing can actually control risks by people's choice of who to marry, of who to mate with. And as you may know, there are a number of projects. There's quite a large-scale project for Ashkenazi Jews, which basically involves getting couples who are considering marriage tested voluntarily and persuading ones where both of them are carriers of the Tay-Sachs gene not to marry each other. Because that causes, I guess 1 in 4, I think, is the odds of a child who's not going to live very long. And there are other genetic diseases for which the same thing is done, especially in a relatively inbred population where this sort of thing is a serious issue. Now, an interesting point, which I'm not sure if I've seen made, though somebody must have made it, is that while this program results in reducing the number of children who show the effect, it increases the frequency of the gene in the population. Do you see why?
Spreads it out, so you're passing carrier genes on other people.
Because normally, if you have two people, each of them carrying one of the recessive gene, there's one chance in four that two copies of that gene are going to be eliminated from the gene pool when you have somebody born who dies early. Whereas this way, that's not happening. But you can argue, I think, plausibly enough, that with the rate of progress in these technologies, by the time that matters, we will have much more sophisticated ways of preventing the problem. And already, of course, something you can do, which doesn't have this problem, is some variant of selective abortion or IVF conception, where you basically fertilize an egg in vitro, wait till it's got 8 cells, pull out one of the cells, which you can at that point do without damaging the so-called pre-embryo, analyze that cell, and if it turns out to have the genetic problem that you're testing against, you throw out that fertilized egg and try again. And of course, you can do the same thing via selective abortion with amniocentesis. And of course, long before modern technologies, people did the same thing via selective infanticide. If the child turns out to be not what you want, you let him die. That's been true of a variety of different societies. But anyway, all of this is getting pretty far afield. I just think it's interesting stuff, and therefore worth mentioning. So this is basically just, what I have here is just a summary of what we just said in the conversation. All right? And I went through those. All right, let's go on now to the actual subject of today, of this week and next week's classes, which is contracts. And what I'm saying here is all pretty obvious, and it's all in the book, but it's probably worth going over. Anyway, a lot of what lawyers do is drawing up and negotiating contracts, and that applies to employment, partnerships, sales, firms, prenuptial agreements, divorce settlements, and I'm sure other things you can think of, loans, and so forth. And in addition, once you've really thought through the logic of contracting, it can then help you make sense of other parts of the law. So that if you ask, should we have a strict liability or a negligence rule for some tort, one way of thinking about it is to say, if we were signing a contract in which we were agreeing that in our interaction with each other certain things might go wrong, under what circumstances am I liable to you for the results, the kinds of issues that are relevant to deciding whether we would prefer that contract are really very much like the issues that are relevant to deciding whether the society should have that legal rule. I like to argue that really what a contract is doing is creating a mini legal system between the contracting parties, covering only a small set of issues, and therefore it raises the same kinds of issues as a legal system in general. So why do we make a contract? First question is, why do we want to deal with other people? Why don't we just each sit on his own island somewhere and ignore the outside world and all those rude people who don't recognize how wonderful we are and don't do what we tell them and all sorts of other ugly and undesirable characteristics? And the short answer is they're against a trade, that there are circumstances in which you and I cooperating can be both better off than we would be separately. One reason for that is that I may have stuff that's worth more to you than it is to me. I have, for example, a huge quantity of children's toys and such representing ages, let us say, 0 to 12 or 13, which are of very little interest to my current 15 and 18-year-old children, not to mention the one who's 30 or so, although his child might be interested in a few of them. And so those things are probably of much greater value to somebody other than me, and therefore there are potential gains to a yard sale or equivalent. In addition, people have different abilities. Actually, going back to the same property being worth more to buyer than seller, I suppose a case which struck me there, though it wasn't really buyer and seller, was when we moved to this area and looked for houses. And we found a house which was about the same size and about the same price as other houses we looked at. It only had two small differences. One of them was that it was almost 100 years old, and we really like old houses, and all houses in this area are like 50 to 0 years old. And the other was that it had a big yard, which is practically non-existent in this area. And of course, we bought it and lived happily there for whatever, 13 years or 14 years now. But what surprised me was that it was at the same price as relatively recent houses of the same size. So I concluded that our taste for old houses was relatively uncommon, not common enough to influence the market price, which was a fortunate gain for us. But in any case, furthermore, different people have different abilities, so that a dinner with the same materials cooked by one person is a feast and by another person it's inedible. That suggests that the latter person might be well advised to hire the former person to do his cooking and perhaps do something else in exchange or give money in exchange for that. Even if people had the identical talents initially, there are advantages to specialization, so that even if you and I are identical twins raised in the same household, nobody can tell us apart at age 12, but for some reason I get interested in carpentry and you get interested in cooking, we both spend lots of time and effort learning our respective interests, and the result is that at age 20, you're a much better cook than I am and I'm a much better carpenter than you are, and we can gain if we, again, do exchanges. So different innate differences are one reason, different specializations are another. And there is complementary abilities in the sense of cases where you and I together can produce more than the sum of what we could produce apart. And the book mentions some of the fairly obvious examples. I should say, for any of you who are contemplating future matrimony, that one of the interesting issues is whether you want a partner who is similar to you or different from you. Because on the one hand, in production, you mostly want somebody who's different. That if you are good at fixing things around the house and a lousy cook, and your wife is a good cook and hates fixing things around the house, that's a great deal for both of you. Or if, to take a real-world example, you are somebody who likes dealing with strangers, who is sort of socially aggressive and outgoing, and your wife is shy and hates having to make a phone call to somebody she's never met to arrange for a doctor's appointment or something, then you've got an arrangement where you can do something that is of low cost and maybe even enjoyable to you, saving her a whole lot of hassle and unpleasantness. So that's the advantage for finding somebody very different. Of course, the flip side is that a large part of your consumption is joint. You're living in the same house, eating the same meals, having the same friends, and there, being similar is going to be an advantage, being different is a disadvantage. And I will leave it to each of you in your respective circumstances to figure out how best to weigh those, and whether you can figure out which are the personality characteristics that are important in production, and which are the ones that are important in consumption. Anyway, another reason is risk sharing, that an insurance company isn't merely transferring risks, it's reducing risks because of the averaging out effects of the law of large numbers. So it's not that before we got insured, I had one chance in 100 of losing $100,000. And after 1,000 of us got insured, the insurance company had one chance in 100 of losing $100 million. That would not be hard to get insurance companies on those terms. What happens is rather that it goes from my one chance in 100 of losing $100,000 to 1,000 people being insured, and now the average loss is $1 million, but that consists of 900,000 one year and 1,100,000 another year, not of once every century you lose 100 million. So that's a respect in which there's a gain. There's one example which they mentioned in the book but didn't discuss, and it seems to me is actually interesting because it raises a sort of a partly philosophical issue, and that's the case where the gains come from the fact that we have different beliefs about the same situation. So take the simplest case which they don't mention, which is a bet. Let us suppose that I bet you, suppose it's before the election, suppose we have a bet on who's going to win the election. And in one sense, the economist's normal view of things is that values are revealed in action. So if I am willing to make a bet at even odds that, say, McCain will win the election, that shows that for me that bet is worth more than it costs. If you are willing to make a bet at even odds that Obama will win the election, that shows that to you the bet is worth more than it costs. Therefore, it looks as though we're both gaining by that bet. And yet, the actual odds that one of them will win the elections are the same for both of us. It's just that one or both of us is mistaken in his opinion about the odds. So there is some objective sense in which one of us is gaining and one of us is losing. And that's whether you do or don't consider that a gain, it seems to me, is a little unclear. Whether you, there are, be a different subject, there are real-world gains from the existence of speculation on markets for various reasons, but it's not clear that the gain that just consists of our having a different opinion and each getting to bet his opinion is a real gain as opposed to a fictitious gain. So that's why you deal with other people. The next question is, why do you need contracts in any complicated sense? That here is an apple, you know, I put an apple in this hand, you put 50 cents in that hand, and I close this hand and open this one. Doesn't look much like a contract, that you could argue it is a contract in a very limited sense. Why do we need more than that? Why do we have something more complicated than ordinary spot sales? And one answer is that performance often takes place over time, and that often the dimensions of performance are more complicated than you can observe when you look at the apple. For example, when you bite into the apple and see half a worm, you may want your 50 cents back. And which is that even a spot contract might include details of quality, and it might include recourse, some way of deciding whether or not I really gave you the apple that you thought you would put. So there are basically two objectives if you're negotiating a contract. One of them is to maximize the size of the pie, and one of them is to get as much as possible for yourself or your client. And normally the reason you have the exchange is there's some surplus that you believe that the two of you are better off making it than not making it in total. And that means you're in a bilateral monopoly bargaining game. That's what we started with, is bilateral monopoly, selling an apple when there was only one apple and only one person who liked apples. What price does it sell for? And both of us are better off agreeing to a contract, but I would rather have a contract in which I pay a low price, and you would rather have a contract in which I pay a high price. And we discussed last week some of the ways in which you can try to do well in such bargaining games, such as commitment strategies, such as control of information, so that, for example, when we were buying our house, we certainly didn't conceal the fact that we liked the house, but we successfully concealed the fact that we liked the house enough so if they had insisted on a $50,000 higher price, we would have paid it. And you can think of lots of ways in which control over information relative to the bargaining may sometimes benefit you. But there's a risk of both commitment strategies and control of information, and that is you may bargain so well that there's no contract. So that if you imagine the case where I tie myself to the mast, as it were, to 60% of the gains, I say, look, I've told all my friends that if I offer you more than $500,000 for the house, that shows I'm an incompetent bargainer, I'm a wimp, and they should think poorly of me. And you say, well, that's really too bad, because I've told all my friends that with a house like this, the only 100-year-old house in West San Jose, if I accept anything less than $600,000, I mean, I should just be ashamed of myself. Well, at that point, the house doesn't sell, and we're both worse off, because it was really, we can imagine, worth $650,000 to me, but I committed myself, so I couldn't pay it. So those are issues that are worth thinking about in terms of bargaining. On the one hand, how you try to get more, but on the other hand, the risk that trying to get more means getting nothing. And the pie goes into the trash. This chapter, however, is not about that. I'm just mentioning that as the part that I'm sort of leaving out, because I don't have as much to say about it. I said everything I have to say about it in the last 2 minutes. Roughly, this chapter is how to maximize the size of the pie. And that's an economically, I think, more interesting and more productive question. And the argument basically is that any time you see a way of increasing the size of the pie, implicit in that is a way of making both parties better off and therefore a change in the contract that both parties should agree to. All right, it's tempting to say, well, yes, it's true, this produces a benefit for you of $100,000, but it produces the cost for me of $50,000, so I'll keep my mouth shut. But this change, I'm imagining a change in the contract, but it's more tempting for you to say, look, if we change the contract in this way, you'll be $100,000 better off. I'd be willing to agree to that if you were willing to cut your price by only $75,000, or raise the price you're paying me according to who's paying whom by only $75,000. And so that suggests a general strategy, which is what the chapter is largely about, which is figure out what form of contract, what details of the contract maximize the net gain to the two parties, and then negotiate to get some of that gain for you. And if people don't find that argument convincing, if they feel there's really no reason why you should worry about the total gain, then we should probably stop at this point and discuss that issue, because it sort of makes the rest of the chapter a little pointless, or most of the rest of the chapter pointless. Comments? Anybody? People are happy with the idea of figuring out how to maximize pies? If any of you, by the way, ever do a economic analysis of law course or are doing one, I'm teaching one at the moment, that is at the moment meaning earlier this afternoon, one of the sort of central issues that gets discussed there on the broader framework is how do you set up legal rules that maximize sizes of pies? All right. So why is it possible that pies can be expanded? And the critical point first is that the world is not a zero-sum game. And that's in one sense obvious and in the other sense hard to convince people of. That there is a sort of a gut-level human reaction, as far as I can tell, if it helps you, it must hurt me. And that's that people routinely say, look, the rich have gotten richer, with the implication that must mean the poor have gotten poorer. It might mean everybody gotten richer. You'd have to look at the facts. And the fact that somebody makes lots of money doesn't necessarily mean that someone else is expensive. It might or might not be. The obvious case, if I sell you something worth more to you than to me, we can both gain, and that applies not only if the something is a thing like the apple we've discussed, but also a term in a contract. That's a point the book makes, but again, it's a simple but important point. Delivery by January 10th is vital to me, because what you're delivering is the stuff that I've contracted to you, that I'm using to produce some goods that I've guaranteed to have on the... Maybe I should make it by December 10th, because you're delivering the inputs for my Christmas products or something. It's costly to you to get it to me by January 10th. The original plan was at the end of the month. But if it's costly but not that costly to you, then there's some price at which we're better off by your modifying the contract to agree to deliver by January 10th than my paying you a higher price. Similarly for defect rates, that it's easy to say, well, what I want is a contract saying there are no defects in the product at all, in which case the other person says, well, how many units do you want? I want 10,000. All right, we figure the odds that we can deliver 10,000 with no defects are about 1 in 100, so I'll charge you 100 times the usual price for that. That doesn't sound like a very good deal. Then what you really want to ask yourself is, how serious a problem is it if there's a defect in of 1 in 100,000, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 100? In some cases, it's a trivial problem. In some cases, you just say, fine, the defects are all going to be obvious as it passes through our hands in the process. We just throw away 1 in 100. That's a 1% in effect increase in cost. If you're willing to cut your price by more than 1% for our accepting that defect rate, it's a great deal. Of course, in other cases, the defect is in some medical product and only reveals itself after the product has been inserted in the human body, at which point it kills you. There, we're willing to tolerate much lower defect rates, although we may still have to tolerate some defect rate, because that may be better than not having the product at all. That would be an example of a term that you could negotiate over. Incentives matter. Let me talk a little bit about incentives, and let me talk about my friend Gordon Tullock's solution to the problem of dangerous driving. There were actually two versions. There was a low-tech and a high-tech version, but even the high-tech version used only off-the-shelf technology. He said, look, suppose you really want to make sure that there are very few highway accidents, people drive safely. Well, he says, we got a really simple way of doing this. We have a legal requirement that every car have in the center of the steering wheel a dagger pointing this direction. All right? The result is people drive very carefully. Number of non-lethal accidents goes down a lot, too. I should say, the high-tech version, he said, look, we've already got these... the procedures, the sensors that we use for airbags to tell when there's been a collision. But an airbag is really a fairly tricky and complicated piece of technology. Why don't we use the same sensor, but replace it with some nice off-the-shelf technology, say a hand grenade? All right? Well, again, he says, he can predict, and he's absolutely right, the death rate from auto accidents will go down. Not the death rate per mile. The death rate per year will go down if we require every car to contain a hand grenade wired to something that will set it off if you have an accident. Those are both examples of the fact that we want is not more incentive, but the right incentive. That we want enough incentive to drive carefully so that you will take those precautions that are worth taking, but not enough so that you will never drive at all unless on life. Unless it's vital to your life, because the costs of an accident are so high. Similarly, if you think about the example which the book gives, where you have a contract to build a house, and you could spend $10,000 on roofing material the last 20 years, the builder spends $5,000 on material the last 5 years, and the roof must then be redone at a cost of $12,000. And the question is, why is this a bad thing? And it's not a bad thing because cheap roofing materials doesn't last as long. It's a bad thing because with those numbers, your total cost for having a roof over your house for 20 years is higher with the bad material. If the bad material cost half as much and lasted almost as long, perfectly reasonable deal, and it would be sensible enough to do it. I have one friend who I actually know mostly online, though I've met him a couple of times, who's sort of, he's a very interesting guy because he basically doesn't believe on taking anything on faith, with the result that he tries to think through all questions. And the result is on the one hand that he has nutty views on some subjects because nobody has enough, he's very bright, but no one has enough hours in the day to really work out to your subject. On the other hand, he has non-standard and interesting views on some subject. One of his views is that one of the things wrong with the American medical system is that you can't buy 1960s medicine at 1960s prices. His argument basically is we have a very expensive medical system. However, it's only moderately better than the much less expensive system of a few decades back. And that there ought to be some way in which you could, in effect, buy medical insurance where you say, I understand that you're agreeing not to do any of the really expensive high-tech modern things. If those happen, I die. Tough luck. But it's only going to cost a fifth as much as the somewhat better service I would get. And that, I don't know if he's right or not, but it's a legitimate point that higher quality medicine is not always desirable. It's only desirable if the benefit to you is greater than the cost. So, in the case of the roofing, if you're designing a contract, you want to design the contract so that your contractor won't buy the cheap material in the first case where it lasts for 5 years, but will buy it where it lasts for 19 years, because ultimately he's going to be saving you money by buying the cheaper material. And you could then buy the cheap material again in 19 years and do it again. Similarly for breaching contracts. Should contracts ever be breached? Should contracts ever be breached? Yes or no?
Yes.
Next. When should they be breached?
Costing more to fulfill the obligation of the contract than it would to break it, whatever other costs.
When the cost to all parties combined of breaking the contract is less than the cost to all parties combined of fulfilling the contract. Simple as it is. What economists call efficient breach, right? And it's easy enough to imagine cases of that sort. There was, in fact, a real case, and I no longer remember for sure how it came out, but it was a case where somebody signed a contract to have an area of land cleared for a development and wanted to breach the contract. And the reason he wanted to breach the contract was the contract was signed about 1928 or 1929, and at the point at which it would have been executed, the Great Depression had started, and it was reasonably clear that there was no market for what he wanted to build on that space of land, and therefore it was clear that the efficient thing to do was not to have him pay the developer the amount he'd agreed to pay to have the developer do what the developer had agreed to do, but to stop the contract then and there. How do you get that outcome? How do you arrange things so that contracts are only breached when they should be? We're drawing up a contract. Either the contract itself or the surrounding legal system specifies what happens if there's a breach. What do we call it if the contract specifies what happens in breach? Liquidated damages. All right, so that's one simple rule. It's got some advantages. It keeps us out of the courts. The alternative is that contract law says if you breach, you owe expectation damages, you owe reliance damages, you owe damages calculated in some way. In principle, what would we like the effect to be, however it's done, whether through liquidated damages or through a court assessing it? What ought I to pay when I breach in order to get me to breach only on the right occasions? We're setting up a liquidated damage rule. All right, we're negotiating a contract. And we say, here are the terms of the contract. By the way, there's some chance that something will happen that will make me want to back out of it. The contract is to paint a portrait of your daughter. There's a chance, not a very good chance, but there's a chance that I'm going to get a phone call from Washington saying, I'd really like a portrait of Michelle. I like that painting of yours that was hanging in some art institute, and I'm willing to pay you a reasonable price. And besides, I think the publicity will be good for your business. All right? And so if that happens, I'm going to want to breach the contract. How in principle should we decide in setting up our liquidated damages how much I owe you if that happens? Or anything else. I mean, I was just trying to be imaginative and reasons for breach. How in principle would we decide what I should owe you if I breach the contract? Is there any simple rule to that?
It would be the cost for the non-breaching party to find somebody else to make a difference in the costs.
That is, I would have said the cost to the non-breaching party, which could mean either the cost to him of finding someone else, or the cost to him of not having the contract completed. So that you could say, if I breach, one thing that happens, you don't pay me. If somebody else is willing to do it tomorrow at the same price, there's no cost to you. Indeed, hardly worth signing a contract in that case, so therefore I don't owe you any damages. If, on the other hand, you made plans based on my doing this, there are reasons why you simply can't replace me in this particular function. Let's take, it's not an exact example, but it's not too far off. Suppose that 2 weeks from now, I get a very attractive offer to teach at Harvard starting 3 weeks from now. All right? Well, there's some sense in which Santa Clara can replace me, but it's a pretty limited sense because we're partway through a particular course. There are no other professors available on the market who will teach the same courses in the same way, knowing what we've done so far. So there's therefore some cost to them, which you could in principle evaluate in terms of how much worse a product they are delivering to their customers, namely you people, plus how much they'd have to pay somebody to get an imperfect replacement for me. If I owe them that much when I breach, then I will only accept the offer at Harvard if it's worth that much more to me than the offer here. So that suggests sort of the general rule, and this is roughly speaking the rule that expectation damages at least theoretically represent, which is that when I breach, I must make you whole. Sort of like tort law, I must make you whole. I must make you as well off as if I hadn't breached. Now, there are a number of complications which we probably won't go into in this class, but I would if I was doing contracts and law. All right, I went through that. I don't know why I have this twice, but that's all right. All right. Second question. One issue is for some giving people the right incentives, and we'll be talking about more about that in the chapter talks about it. But another question is observability and enforceability. And I have one of my favorite law and econ stories here, which comes from a 10th century Islamic source. I think that's where it's from. And the story is that a certain vizier was going about the countryside, taking petitions and giving alms and dealing with what must be dealt with. And he received a petition for alms from a poor woman. And he wrote out, pay this woman 200 dinar. And he gave the writing to the woman to take to his treasurer. And when the woman presented the writing to the treasurer was astonished that his master would give such a large sum in alms to a poor woman. And so he took the writing back to the vizier and he said, Master, is this your hand? And the vizier said, it is. It was my intention to write, pay this woman 200 dirham. But since it was the will of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, that my hand slipped and I wrote dinar for dirham, gold instead of silver, pay it out as it is written. And so it was commanded and so it was done. 3 days later, the vizier received a petition from a poor man. And the petitioner said that 3 days before, the vizier had given his wife 200 dinar, and that she had now decided that she was too wealthy to be married to a poor old man like him, and was threatening to force her husband to divorce her. And the man asked the vizier to appoint somebody in authority to prevent his wife from forcing him to divorce her. And the vizier thought a moment, took paper and pen, and wrote, pay this man 200 dinar. So what's the point of the story? The point of the story, see, obviously part of the context of this is that under Muslim law, it is relatively easy for a man to divorce his wife, and there isn't, except in extreme cases, I think, a mechanism by which a wife can divorce her husband. So from a legal standpoint, the wife can't force her husband to divorce her. How, in fact, can a wife force her husband to divorce her in such a system? What?
Make life hell,
right. Make being divorced better than the alternative. And the implication of the story is that the very powerful vizier has no way of preventing that, and therefore falls back on the alternative of giving an equal sum to the man, so now the wife will be willing to stay married to him. All right? And that, I think, is a neat story. And it's a neat story, in a sense, about the enforceability of contracts, about the fact that the terms of the marriage contract are that the husband can breach and the wife can't. That would be enforceable if performance was observable. If it was easy for the husband to go to the whoever it is the vizier appoints to take care of this problem and say, look, taste this dinner my wife made for me last night. It's more salt than meat. If the kinds of ways in which a partner to a marriage misperforms were the kinds easily demonstrated to third parties, then indeed it would be an enforceable contract, and then the wife wouldn't have a viable threat. But the implication of the story, which I think is true, is that as a practical matter, there are enough different ways in which you can make being married to you unpleasant that you can't use external parties to enforce that particular contract, and that the result in that case, at least, was that he couldn't do it. And in general, it's worth thinking about. The book doesn't really discuss it, but it's an important real-world issue, the whole problem of marriage contracts. Because it is really quite a difficult problem, and it's sort of easy at each point to say the way we're doing it now, or the way they were doing it 50 years ago, doesn't matter, is obviously wrong for the following reason. Yeah, well, what's your alternative? Ah, that's obviously wrong for the following reason. What, and so forth. It's the kind of thing where it looks like there is really no good solution. Because on the one hand, both parties make large investments of time and emotion in each other, in their children, such that just saying, well, this is like a spot contract, anytime you're unhappy, you leave, isn't a very satisfactory solution. But on the other hand, if you're not allowed to leave without the other party's assent, you then have the incentive to make the other party give assent by doing a very bad job of performing your side of the contract. You could prevent that if the terms of the contract were obvious and enforceable, but they aren't, and you sort of go round and round and round with this set of problems. There's a friend of mine, Lloyd Cohen, wrote an article that made him very unpopular with people that should have made him popular with, which was basically, the title of it was, let's see, part of the title was, I gave him the best years of my life. And he was basically arguing that what happened with easy divorce was that, as he imprudently put it, women depreciate fast and men slowly on the marriage market. The way he should have put it was, in the marriage contract, women perform early and men perform late. That is to say, in a traditional marriage, the woman is producing children and raising them. That's done when you're relatively young. The man is providing income. That's something you get better and better at as you grow older. And if you think about the logic of contracts, one of the things that might occur to you is that if one party performs early and one party performs late, there's an incentive for the late-performing party to wait till you're halfway through and then breach. And Lloyd argued that was exactly what had happened, hence I gave him the best years of my life. And he went on to argue that as it became clear this was happening, people then readjusted their behavior, had started having children later, specialized less in being wives and more in marketplace skills and so forth. So it was really an interesting piece. And I think feminists should have liked it, but in fact, I think his choice to put it in terms of rates of depreciation of men and women offended some of the people who, I think, should have liked the actual argument he was making. But it was a neat point, and it pointed out the difficulty with the easy divorce system, and presumably it's pretty obvious that's what the difficulties are with the hard divorce system, since those are sort of part of our tradition as well. In any case, we may come back to this question, but it's worth thinking about it. And notice that the question of whether terms are observable, which is partly what I'm talking about, isn't always a sharp distinction. You might be able to say, well, we can tell if the house falls down, but we can't tell if it's going to last 100 years or 30 years because we're not going to wait that long. But you could also specify how you tell it. You can say, look, I agree that my house will, that the house will be built according to the building codes of the city of San Jose. And you could agree to that even if you weren't building it in San Jose, if that was just a convenient way of specifying a bunch of quality dimensions that you didn't want to go into in detail. Second enforceability problem, and one relevant certainly to lawyers, is what if a party breaches but can't pay? And you can't get blood from a stone. Further point, which the book makes, but it's an important point, is that while most of our analysis is in terms of sort of short-term maximization, one house contract, in practice there are other constraints, and in particular, players who are repeat players have to worry about reputation. So that if you are a home builder and you see a great opportunity to cheat your customer, you're going to have a problem if the result is that all the other people who want homes built talk to your customer. They say, you know, you were his first customer. What are you doing? Look at this thing. I mean, you know, we're lucky we still got a roof over our house 3 years from now. Roof over our heads 3 years from now. You don't get to build any more houses. And you can think of a lot of milder cases in both directions. You can think of a case where a company says, look, we don't have any legal obligation to fix that particular problem. We're going to do it anyway. Because you will then tell all your friends what wonderful people we are. And I think I've observed cases of that sort as well. So either a repeat player with the same party or with different party who talks to each other, reputations matter. And notice that that's another reason to think about maximizing the size of the pie. Because even if in this particular case the change you suggest benefits the other guy and doesn't affect you, that still makes you more popular as somebody for other people to contract with. The fact that when you see opportunities at a low cost to you to help your contractual partner, you're willing to go along. And an interesting question is, do you want to think of that purely as strategy or as moral behavior, as ethical behavior? And one possibility that I think is worth at least considering is maybe that's all ethics is. That maybe the only reason that human beings are not short-term selfish maximizers is that they live in a world of repeat games and have therefore trained themselves to care about other people, because if you obviously don't care about other people, people are going to be very unwilling to do things with you, essentially. That's one possible interpretation of ethical behavior. We'll be returning later to reputation, because one of the considerations in designing a contract is reputational constraints. In particular, if we have a case where, however we structure the contract, one party or the other will be in a position to cheat. You can imagine a case where you say, well, pay in advance. I can't cheat you on the payment, but you can cheat me on the performance. Pay on completion. You can't cheat me on the performance, but I can then stiff you when it comes time to pay. If you are in that kind of situation, one thing to do is say which of the parties is constrained by reputational considerations. If one of us can't afford to be seen to cheat because of his reputation, the other is only playing this game once and is never going to see anybody else again, then we'd better put the burden upon, make sure that the person who can't cheat is the one who would, not the one who wouldn't, so to speak. So that's an interesting point worth thinking about. So let's consider the particular example which they discuss, and that's building a house and the distinction between cost plus and flat fee. And so one question is, if you have a cost, I assume you all know, flat fee is, I pay you $100,000, you build the house to the following specifications. Cost plus is you build the house, you send me your record of your expenditures, I pay your expenditures plus $10,000. Or I pay your expenditures plus 10%. Two questions which the book I think really doesn't go into. Why is there any plus in cost plus? Why don't we just say, you build the house, send me your expenses, I'll pay them. Why am I willing, if one guy demands cost plus $10,000, why doesn't another contractor always say, I'll do it for cost $9,000, first guy say $8,000, why don't I always bargain them down to cost plus a penny? Anybody?
cost is just the cost of the product, not the time.
That's right, because there are dimensions of the cost that aren't going to show up on the paperwork. Exactly. So the $10,000, roughly speaking, is his time, effort, expertise, and so forth in supervising the project. He can only do a certain number of projects in a year, so by doing mine, he's giving up the opportunity to do yours, and therefore he expects to be paid for it, right? I don't think the book ever makes that point. It seems to me it's worth noticing. But the second question, which is a little more puzzling, is what determines whether it's plus a fixed amount or plus 10%, which I think they also don't discuss. Why, putting it differently, what's the case in which it would be appropriate to make it plus 10%? Where you don't know in advance how big the project is going to be, and roughly speaking, the amount of his time and effort required is going to scale with the price. So if you imagine the kind of project where we're excavating the basement for a house, if we're lucky and it all goes well, it'll be over in a week. If we're not lucky, it's going to take a month. Well, that's a week versus a month of the contractor's time to revise the project. So that would seem like a perfectly reasonable way. Whereas you can think of other cases where the relevant variable is not how long it's take, it's whether the price of concrete goes up or down in the meantime. Well, that isn't going to determine the contractor's cost, same amount of time and effort either way. So, let's think about the incentive to save money. Flat fee is perfectly straightforward, that if you're getting a flat fee and you're a contractor, dollar saved is a dollar earned. All right, if you can find a way of hiring somebody who costs less, or buying a less expensive input, finding the input on sale or whatever, that's all money for you. And that's exactly what you want. And notice that in that case, the contractor is taking account of both money savings and of non-money savings. That if he could save $50 on the windows, but only by spending 10 hours searching out different suppliers, sorry, 10 hours of his time is worth more than $50, he won't do it. So he's then got an incentive to minimize money plus time and effort costs. Why do you care about that? Why do you say that looks like a good idea? Why don't you want to set up the incentives so you'll always get the product as cheaply as possible, however much effort it takes? That's it. We haven't gotten to that issue yet. That's the quality issue. We're going to get there, but I haven't gotten there yet. Just suppose that all the question is the longer they're all identical, the longer he searches, the better price he can get. Why don't you want to keep him searching as long as he can get a better price?
Is it a project takes so long?
But ultimately, because if you try to set up the contract, though, his reply is going to be, oops, I guess it's going to take me twice as much work as I thought, so it's going to be cost plus $20,000, not cost plus $10,000. Right? That is to say, anything that imposes costs on him, you can expect to impose costs on you, provided he anticipates his imposing costs on him before he signs the contract. So therefore, if you set up the contract in a way, and suppose the terms of the contract are, he is legally obliged to find the cheapest goods. And we can somehow enforce that, which would be hard to do. He might be willing to sign that, but he'd only sign that with a substantially larger bonus because he would realize he would then have to search well beyond the point at which he would search on a fixed flat fee contract. So you want to take account of costs to him and to you because the costs to him are relevant to the terms on which he'll agree to the initial contract. Right? So, therefore, flat fee looks as though from the standpoint of saving costs, it's ideal. Cost plus, on the other hand, any increase in time and trouble needed to get the lower price is paid by him. The benefit all goes to you, so he's not going to try very hard to find the lower price, even if it's worth doing, even if an hour's worth of work would save you $200. Cost plus 10%, I have to tell you Friedman's rule for finding the men's room. This is not discriminatory because the same rule, mutatis mutandis, works for finding the women's room. The rule is the men's room is adjacent in one of the three dimensions to the women's room. All right, this is a usually correct prediction. It may be above it rather than next to it, but it means if you've seen one, you've got a good guess at where the other is. Why is this true? This is true because of the economies of scale in plumbing stacks, because it is cheaper. The plumbing stack is the set of pipes used that you need for a kitchen or a restroom or something. And it is cheaper to have one set of plumbing that will service two rooms, which you can do if they're next to each other, than to have two sets at opposite ends of the building. When is it not true? In buildings built at cost plus 10%. All right? So that's an illustration of the problem. It's also not true in the basement, usually, because in the basement you've got your plumbing stack running horizontally, so therefore you can have things on the same stack at some distance apart.
And sometimes things become impossible because you have to drop them.
Yes. I'm not arguing that Friedman's rule works perfectly, but it's nonetheless quite a useful rule of thumb, especially when you're in a hurry. Next question, of course, is quality. We've talked about incentive with regard to price, with regard to quality. Do we always want the highest quality inputs? No, we don't. We don't all. Even if I could afford, I'm not sure that a Lamborghini or the equivalent really is a higher quality car than a Honda Accord. But even if I could afford, I suppose it would probably be the appropriate Infiniti or... I don't know. My impression is that the Japanese luxury brands are probably the best cars at this point if you're interested in reliability and stuff like that and not in showing off. Even if I can afford it, it isn't sensible to buy it if the value of the additional quality is less than its cost. Ditto for restaurant, ditto for practically everything else. So what do we want in terms of quality when we're building our house? It's basically the same answer to all the questions. When do you want more quality? When it's worth more than it costs. Right? Whatever the reason that you value the quality. If the quality means the thing will last longer, figure out how much that saves you, how much extra does the quality cost, is it or isn't worth it. If the quality is aesthetics, you say, how much more would I like living in a house with beautiful hardwood floors instead of carpeted floors? Got to make that trade-off, decide if it's worth it. So you would like, therefore, to set things up so that you'll get the higher quality product when it's worth it, not when it isn't. That's a harder problem than doing the same with the price, unfortunately, because with the price we know exactly how much a dollar savings in price is worth. It's worth a dollar. It's hard to know, or harder to know, how much a given change in quality is worth. With a flat fee contract, the incentive of the builder is to use the least expensive inputs, which includes the case where they're less expensive because they're lower quality. Cost plus contract, he doesn't care whether they're high quality or not. Sometimes he might. There might be cases where the high quality requires either more or less of his effort to find it or to install it or something, but normally he doesn't care. Cost plus 10%, he may have an incentive to buy higher quality than you want because that'll increase his 10%. And then the question is, if you have a flat fee contract where this problem arises, how might you try to control it? How do you keep him from buying junky quality everything?
Specify the quality in the contract.
You specify the quality in the contract.
Or require approval.
Or what?
Require approval.
You could require approval, prior approval, you mean. Yeah, that would be possible. But you could, in a sense, part of what this chunk of the chapter is really about is what problems arise each way in order that you can both decide which are more serious and therefore whether to use a fixed payment or something like a cost plus, and so that having decided on one, you'll see the problems and can do your best to control them. And the difficulties are pretty obvious, that you know less about quality than he does. When he tells you, well, you haven't heard of this brand, but it's really a first-rate brand, you don't know whether he's telling the truth or not. And obviously one possible way of dealing with that is to get another expert, to get the architect to specify, or to use somebody's building code if there's a building code you think you trust. And you can imagine other cases. One which isn't discussed is you say, well, I understand. I've been told that you're actually building a house for yourself in the same development, right? Well, how about you just duplicate that one for us? Same quality of everything. All right, and that might be one way. Now, he might, of course, then shave his own quality a bit in order to save money on yours, but he wouldn't do it very much unless he wants his wife to be really mad at him when she moves into the house and sees what kind of a junky refrigerator he got her. So that would be a different, more innovative way, as it were, of trying to do it. In a sense, the general problem of what economists call incentive-compatible rules, of how you set up arrangements so that people have the incentives to behave in the way that you want them to behave is sort of a very broad problem in life, and it's an interesting one. And since I have a minute free, let me tell you my favorite incentive compatibility story. Happens in old Texas. Jose robs a bank and flees south across the Rio Grande into old Mexico, hotly pursued by the Texas Rangers. And the Rangers come up with him in a small town in Mexico, only to discover that none of them speak Spanish and Jose speaks no English. So they draft the local school teacher. Have I told you this story before? No. They draft the local school teacher as translator. And the Rangers say to the school teacher, ask Jose where he's hidden the money. The gringos want to know where you've hidden the money. Tell the gringos I will never tell them. Jose says he will never tell you. The Rangers draw their six guns, cock them, point them at Jose's head. Tell Jose if he does not tell us, we will kill him. The gringos say, if you do not tell them, they will kill you. Jose begins to tremble with fear. I buried it by the oak tree, by the river. Jose says he's not afraid to die. That's an incentive compatibility story. And the losers are the Rangers. I mean, Jose also, but the Rangers are the ones who made the mistake. It's not at all. Well, it wasn't his fault. He didn't set it up. The Rangers set it up, and they set it up wrong. But anyway, so that's my incentive compatibility story.